And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our next guest is Dr. Nikki Fox, who's the Heliophysics Division Director in the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now, heliophysics is the science of the sun, which studies the physical connections between the sun and our solar system. We will speak with Nikki about NASA's heliophysics program, including the Parker Solar Probe that will take measurements from the sun's corona, where it is 2,500 degrees, and the solar orbiter, which will help us answer how the sun creates and controls the giant bubble of magnetic fields around it. Dr. Nikki Fox, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
We are delighted to have you with us today, and I wanted to start with this. Up until about 60 years ago, we believed that space was a void. It was empty. It was a vacuum. There was nothing going on in space. And then Eugene Parker wrote this article that was controversial, and he said that charged particles flow from the sun like the flow of water. People dismiss this as ludicrous. And then 4 years later, Mariner 2 confirmed that there were particles. And now we have a spectacular spacecraft, which is named after Eugene Parker. It's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. And even before Parker's paper, of course, James Van Allen had launched Explorer 1, and that was the time that we realized, hey, there's actually something in space. He had a very simple instrument on that called a Geiger counter, and it just picked up all these signals, but only in a region when it was going through those radiation belts. And he asked his engineers to essentially calibrate the instrument to make this annoying signal go away. And then they discovered, hey, it's not an annoying signal, it's a real thing. And as a result of that and many other kind of forces, they put together a committee, it's called the Simpson Committee, in 1958, and John Simpson and James Van Allen were the co-chairs of this, and it was all these really smart people that got together to really decide what those magical things, what those huge, huge missions would be that would really drive the need to form agencies like NASA, the National Science Foundation, and also to give guidance to the DOD on what we would do with this newfound thing called space. And this committee, they put forward a number of different mission concepts, and one of them was a probe to go into the sun's corona, a solar probe, and that was really purely driven by Eugene's controversial paper. As you just said, people didn't believe it. He actually told me that when he got his referee reports, one of them even said, if you're going to publish in this area of science, you should really go to the library first. And then he likes to tell me that was the nice review. but fortunately, we had a good editor who realized, hey, this is a controversial subject and there's a lot of interest in it. And so he published anyway. And as you noted, just a few years later, Marcia Neugebauer, the scientist that was really leading the investigation, discovered these particles were very much accelerated, just as Gene had predicted in his paper. So, yes, unfortunately, it takes time to mature technology to be able to do these kind of missions. I mean, obviously, it's going into a very intense area of heat and also radiation. And even though we did wonderful science in that 60 years, we looked at the sun from every different wavelength. We went in as far as the planet Mercury, and we really almost just heightened our excitement for what we were going to find when we got into that region with a mission. And then in 2018, our dreams came true, and we launched the Parker Solar Probe, and she's been doing great groundbreaking science ever since.
And she is in the process of making a number of Venus flybys. I think she launched in 2018, so she has another 5 years of maybe five or six more Venus flybys before she can position herself at the edge of the corona?
Well, she's already in the corona, and it kind of it depends. You know, people really discuss the corona in different terms. There's different ways of sort of measuring it, but she's really in the active region. In fact, we were surprised, shocked even, at just the sheer amount of activity and fabulous great new science that we found even on the very first orbit. And so you're right, she's actually done two Venus flybys. She is heading in right now. In June, she will encounter, she'll do her fifth flyby. And then following that, she will do her third Venus flyby. So after that, she'll be even closer.
It's really fascinating work, Nikki. And I just wanted to say that I was watching a little video from NASA and the heliophysics department. And I was so pleased, and this is a departure from the Parker Solar Probe, but I can't help but commenting on the number of female scientists within your department. It's really fantastic.
Yes. Obviously, I'm a big fan. But yes, we have a really, really fabulous workforce and a very, very diverse group. And of course, we all know that diverse teams are always stronger teams. And so we really are enjoying that. I'll note just actually on Parker Solar Probe, there are actually more female leads than male leads. Not that the male leads were not absolutely fabulous, and I don't mean to make it sound any other way. The team was just first class. But yes, we had a lot of females in lead roles on the Parker mission.
And we find that across the board whenever we speak with NASA. It seems like it's just so easy to, I know one of your missions is to communicate what is going on at NASA and what you do in heliophysics with the world. And, it's a gift that women have typically is to be able to communicate in a way that sort of spreads the excitement.
Yes, to be honest, I think if you really enjoy what you do, it's very easy to talk about it. And I don't think there's anyone that works for NASA that doesn't really enjoy what they do. I mean, it's like a dream come true job for everybody. And so, you're working on such incredible missions. The technology is amazing. The teams are just totally incredible, and the science results are mind-blowing. And so, everything we do is hard, and everything we do is challenging, and it's just a really, really, really exciting place to work and a really exciting field to be in.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Nikki Fox. She's the Heliophysics Division Director in the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Nikki, back in July 23rd, 2012, there was a massive solar storm. The sun released two back-to-back large coronal mass ejections of plasma, big clouds of plasma. And they crossed the Earth's orbit, but the Earth fortunately was not there, missed us by about a week. Could have knocked us back into the Mad Max world. Maybe not. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but I do know that transformers take a long time to build, so if we had transformers knocked out, we could have been in the Stone Age for at least a year or two, I guess. But what sort of safeguards do we have in place for early warning that may help us in the future?
So we have a fleet of spacecraft that are really strategically located. We have the missions that are sort of upstream from us, and so they are detecting. They're either looking at the sun all the time, and they can tell us when these big events are coming our way. And then we have sort of like warning lights upstream from us, if you like, that when the event hits those spacecraft, it's typically about 20 minutes to an hour after that we'll see the effects here at Earth. And so NASA works very closely with our partner agency NOAA. They do the actual predictions. We do all the science that really enables the improvements in the predictions and the improvements in the models that they use. And so we're very excited with this partnership. We do have assets that are dedicated to really measuring what's coming from the sun and helping us to improve our knowledge of what will happen at Earth based on what is coming from the sun. And in the heliophysics division, we've actually just recently selected some new missions which will fly in about 2023-24. One of them is going to be taking very high resolution images of the sun's corona. It's called Punch. It's four spacecraft that operate together. Three of them form like a wide angle telescope in space, and the other one is a narrow angle telescope, and they'll be looking directly at the sun's corona, kind of almost looking at it from the inside out and letting us really study those phenomena. And then another mission is Sunrise, which is six little CubeSats. So they're really, really small spacecraft. But they are going to go out into the solar wind, and they're going to position themselves so they're going to form like a giant array. It's like a big radio dish in space. And, you know, with most things, if you want to do very, very, very precise measurements, then you need a very big collection area. But it's very hard to fly giant radio arrays in space. So these little CubeSats are going to kind of form a virtual one by talking to one another and telling us what they're all seeing, and we can put it together into a grid. And that will really help us understand radio signals are traveling much faster than the actual plasma. And so if you can detect the radio signals that are associated with that event, that's going to give us really transformational ability to predict what is coming from the sun to the earth. And so, but you're absolutely right. We were 7 days off being in the path of that big, it was actually a giant coronal mass ejection, actually predicted to be even bigger than the very famous Carrington event back in 1859, which was actually the first time we realized that the sun and the earth were connected even. Bright flashes on the sun, a few hours later, big events here at Earth. And that was the first time we realized that there was a big connection between the two. But yes, that July event was even bigger than that. And so what we would have done, of course, is if we were in that sort of the zone of impact from that event, is we would have seen that giant event, and we would have started to take steps to actually protect things like power grids. There's a very big difference if you very carefully take down a power grid in a controlled way. When the event has passed, you can bring it back up. It's inconvenient. People lose power for a short time, but it will safeguard to a certain extent against exactly what you were speaking about, which is the transformer damage. And so there are a lot of things that we can do to protect ourselves as a society, but the more we understand the sun and its impacts on the earth, the better we are able to forecast and therefore really safeguard ourselves.
Yeah, and I'm sorry about the Mad Max reference. That might have been a little
dramatic. Oh, that's fine. But, I thought it was good, actually.
But how catastrophic could it have been, and the safeguards that you so carefully took us through, which is fascinating, was that a result of that July 23rd incident?
I mean, there have always been safeguards in place. We had other events that have happened. You know, back in 1989, there was a famous Hydro-Quebec incident where the power grid along the eastern seaboard in Canada kind of went down for a long period of time and caused quite a bit of damage. So things have been really sort of put in place. And again, the more we know about the sun, the more we actually understand the impact on us, and the more reliant we become on technology, the more important it is for us to become a resilient community. But the prediction for that particular July event was about $2 to $3 trillion if the U.S. was in a particular region. And so it all depends on kind of where you are in the world at the time, or rather where the world is within the Sun-Earth line system. But if we'd been in the sort of the worst possible place for impact, if the eastern seaboard had been kind of around midnight when the events were really getting to a maximum, then we would have seen huge impacts to our technology. And it isn't just the power grids, undersea cables, long pipelines that flow, and then anything in the satellite, you know, the GPS signals. We can have loss of spacecraft. We can have damage to solar panels. There are a whole slew of space weather impacts. And, you know, we all forget just how reliant we are on GPS. I mean, good grief, none of us take a map anywhere. We just pull out our phone and plug it in. And you know, if you lose your cell service or you lose the GPS ability, then we're very impacted by things that come from the sun.
We actually can't even fathom being without those things now. And it makes it so interesting to know that, you know, what you do is studying, as you say, the effects of the sun on our solar system. And I think it's really interesting to explore a little further and in a little greater detail for our listeners, space weather in general. So we've talked about coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, and we have solar storms and solar flares. Can you go into each one of those a little bit more? And which of those can we see with the naked eye as, you know, we're driving down the freeway at night and see something off in the night sky?
Yes, certainly. So a solar storm is just really kind of an umbrella phrase we use to mean any big solar activity. A solar flare is a bright flash of light. It's usually the precursor to a big event. It doesn't always have to be, but it usually is associated with a very big event when we see what we call X-class flares. And so they are incredibly energetic, but it's a bright flash of light, and that is in fact what Carrington saw back in 1859. He saw a bright flash of light. He was looking through his telescope and sketching sunspots on the sun, and he suddenly saw what he called bright fireballs on the surface of the sun around this active region. And so that particular feature that will travel, obviously, at the speed of light, it's a bright flash of light, but it often accelerates with it really, really high energy particles. And these are kind of nasty particles. They are high energy. They move about half the speed of light, and they actually have a mass. So they're not little electrons, they're the protons, and they have a mass associated with them. So they can actually smash into solar panels. They can really cause a kind of a snowy effect on, how your old TV used to have a snowy effect on it, mm-hmm. if it wasn't tuned properly. And so we see that often on the cameras. It's just a buildup of particles on the surface of our cameras. And so they can sort of blind the cameras for a while. But they're all associated with the flare. And then kind of behind that comes the main event. And so John already referred to like big blobs of plasma, and that's what it is. It's big blobs of coronal material. So that hazy atmosphere we see around the sun during an eclipse, that's the corona. And it actually is made of a material. It isn't just light. It's actually got substance behind it. And those big blobs will get accelerated to usually around 2 to 3 million miles an hour. The solar wind that we talked about, that Eugene Parker discovered, typically flows at about 1 million miles an hour. So these things are accelerated to 2, 3, 4 times that speed. So that is pushing the solar wind. And so you already alluded to two CMEs back-to-back that went off in July of 2013. And that was one of the reasons that was so active is the first one kind of cleared the way. It was almost like the advance guard going out and clearing the way, and then it just let the second CME accelerate rocket from the sun, and that was why that was such a big event. So they're the sort of the main ingredients behind solar storms. We can see some effects without others occasionally, but normally for those really big events, we'll see all of those different phenomena kind of in a sequence, and they all have different impacts on us here at Earth or on spacecraft in orbit. And of course, for now, as we're all excited at NASA, of course, for our launch, unfortunately scrubbed yesterday, but I'm very, very much looking forward to launching America again, and very much now looking as we move forward to embrace the Artemis mission to return, to put the first woman and the next man on the moon and then onto Mars. Astronaut safety becomes once again a big, big challenge for us. It's always the number one priority of NASA to look after our astronauts, but as we're now looking at them spending extended time in the solar wind, as the moon is often outside the protective environment of the Earth, and of course as we travel to Mars, we'll be a long time in the solar wind, and so really ratcheting up the ability to observe and predict space weather events in the solar wind.
So you've talked about the Carrington event back in 1859. You've been referring to the July 2013 event. And was it 2012 or 2013?
2012. I misspoke. I apologize.
Okay. But in between those, I mean, how often are we seeing these huge events that are affecting either our power grid or aircraft navigation or satellite or ground communication?
So, I mean, they don't need to be giant events to actually have impacts. Small space weather events are happening all the time, and so we do see small impacts, large impacts, depending on the size of the event. It was thought that the Carrington-level events were about a 1-in-100-year event, but one thing we realized as we now have more spacecraft and are more able to observe these events, that they happen probably a lot more frequently. It's just we're not in the path to really observe them. And so that big event, we, July 2012, went off the side, and it actually impacted one of our stereo spacecraft, and we were able to record the size of the event. Otherwise, we would never have known it was such a big event. We were just lucky that we had a spacecraft in the right place. And so as we evolve with our observational needs, you know, one of our goals is to be able to increase the number of spacecraft we have making those in situ measurements. So not just able to look at the sun, but actually able to measure what is coming away from the sun and what would impact the Earth, regardless of its location on the sun's surface.
We're speaking with Dr. Nikki Fox. She's the Heliophysics Division Director for the Science Mission Directorate in NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Heliophysics is the science of the sun. It studies the physical connections between the sun and our solar system. Nikki, I didn't really realize until a little while ago that we are in the sun's atmosphere, and going out to Pluto and beyond, that's still part of the sun's atmosphere, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. In fact, one of the things the sun also does for us is actually protects us from interstellar space. So as the solar system, as our sun, is orbiting around the Milky Way, it is actually the solar wind is creating kind of like a bubble around us that protects us from interstellar space. And so the sun's atmosphere, or the solar wind, is accelerated, and it bathes all of the planets, and it goes all the way out to there's a boundary, and of course our Voyager spacecraft, which are in their, I think, 42 years they've been going, they've actually crossed through this boundary region and are now sampling interstellar space. And so with the heliophysics fleet, we go all the way from the very inside, the very close to the sun with Parker Solar Probe, and then all the way out to the very edge of the solar wind influence, which is where our voyages are. So the solar wind is good for many things, but definitely protecting us from a lot of the stuff in interstellar space is one of its prime functions.
Nikki, you run a program that has a number of spacecraft, a number of missions, a number of people within your organization. You have other organizations you collaborate with and work with. And I know that you're a very curious person. What one question would you like to have answered about the sun that has not been answered yet?
Oh, see, I would love to know more about what goes on at the sun's poles. So there are many different predictions about what we'll see there. And, of course, we've just launched Solar Orbiter in partnership with ESA. So we're very excited about particularly the coordinated measurements that mission will do with Parker Solar Probe. But one of the main goals of Solar Orbiter is to move out of the ecliptic, so out of the sort of sun-Earth plane, and move towards the northern hemisphere, and so that they will be able to look down from their angle and be able to image the poles for the very first time. We've sampled the actual material. We flew the Ulysses mission a number of years ago that made a couple of crosses through the sun's poles, and was able to show us a very, very different picture from solar minimum, which is our quiet time on the sun, where we have the least number of sunspots, to solar maximum, which is a roughly 11-year cycle from end to end, so about 5.5 years between solar min and solar maximum, and a very, very different looking profile as it crossed at solar maximum compared to solar minimum. So we know that the poles are very active, and the certainly there's huge coronal holes up there, which is letting this the solar wind, it's accelerating the solar wind very fast. And there's just lots of excitement up there, but we've never actually been able to image it. So really the importance of what's going on at the solar poles is something that I'm super looking forward to with these two missions. Eventually, of course, we'd love to have a mission that's really focused on the sun's poles, that is not only able to image them, but also to be able to make in-situ data measurements as it crosses over it. So that's, I think, a long-term goal for many heliophysicists, is really understanding what's going on with those poles. Many people think if you can really look at the poles and understand what's going on during solar minimum, it will actually kind of tell you what's going to happen at the next solar maximum as the activity cycle picks up, and there is a prediction that what's at the poles will actually move down towards the equator, and we'll be able to tell how active a solar cycle will be. That's a very controversial theory. A lot of people think that isn't true, but it will be great to find that out.
Absolutely. So I just have to ask you, so for the armchair heliophysicist or the backyard heliophysicist or someone who's just interested in seeing a little bit or learning a little bit more about solar weather, you know, what do you suggest for someone with just the naked eye?
So actually, I realize I didn't answer one of your questions, which is what we can see with the naked eye to let us know that we have a big space weather event. And of course, the easiest answer for that is the aurora. And normally, the aurora is kind of located around the latitude of the Arctic Circle, and of course, the same in the Southern Hemisphere too. But as these big events happen, the aurora gets pushed closer and closer to the equator, it gets pushed equatorward, I should say. And so, you know, if you're in the U.S., often people will see aurora up in the, Iowa, Nebraska area. That's quite common to be able to see aurora up there. Of course, southern Canada, very, very often to see them. But if you start seeing aurora closer to mid-latitudes, anything that's, you know, around New York, D.C., and anything further south, you've got a very, very big event in place. And so one thing, if you're just interested in following that, is you may not live in an area where you can see the aurora all the time, but there are many resources on the internet that will let you either look at ground all-sky cameras. We've got a whole network in Canada that we cooperate with for our Themis mission, there are many other ground-based observatories that you can actually look at to be able to see where the aurora are, how active they are. We'll tell you how much energy is coming in from the solar wind. And then even just looking, you can join many citizen science projects. Aurorasaurus is one in particular, where people just report, hey, I'm seeing an aurora, and you can actually build up a network to be able to know where the aurora is at any given time. So that's a great way to be able to follow space weather and its impacts here on Earth.
I believe you can also look at the sun real time. There's a camera pointed at the sun all the time, maybe the Japanese spacecraft.
There are a number with NASA. We have our Solar Dynamics Observatory, which is looking at the sun 24/7, you can look at the disk of the sun in the highest resolution imaginable. They are phenomenal images. In fact, to see them at full resolution, you actually need a planetarium dome. They are that high resolution. also, we have our coronagraphs on SOHO, which is out in the solar wind stereo. We have a number of cameras that are going in real time, you can actually follow along with us, either looking at the corona with a coronagraph, and so that is creating an artificial eclipse. Instead of waiting for the moon to cross and cover the disk of the sun, we fly an occulter disk on these cameras. It blocks out the sun, and we can actually look at that hazy corona all the time. Many ways that you can follow what we're doing.
Dr. Nikki Fox, who is the Heliophysics Division Director for the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in D.C. Nikki, you are welcome on this program anytime you would like to join us.
Oh, thank you.
We love talking
to
you.
That's
we
great.
Really do.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah,
you
and listen, I believe the current window is Saturday for the Falcon 9.
Yes, that's right. I will have my commercial crew t-shirt on again. The whole family has one, even the dog. So we'll be wearing them and ready to go on Saturday. Yes. Go DM2.
Yeah, break a leg, Nikki. Thank you.
Thanks,
thank you
Nikki.
So much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. When we return, we have with us here Matthew Cobb, who has written The Idea of the Brain, The Past, Future of Neuroscience. Stay with us.